You're listening to episode, I don't know, 52?
52?
Yeah. 49?
What about episode 44?
Don't worry about it. The Ninja Consultant podcast. And we have with us today our guest, James, who's going to tell tales of corporate blackmail in the early days of anime fandom.
I'm an angry otaku.
That's what you go by.
That's my handle.
Right.
You can also see his rants on opon.net.
Well, we try to keep that a serious podcast.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I ranted once.
Except for that one episode.
Yeah, but then we try to interview anime luminaries that we have in our Rolodex that have exhausted their own earning potential and have nothing better to do. So, no, that's not true. No, we try to come off cool. AnimePodcast.net. There. My plug is over.
There's your plug.
Yes.
That's one plug.
Put that sheet away.
I don't care if you're selling a book. All right.
So before we get to the anecdotes, what is your background?
That's going to take forever.
I'll get a summary. But otherwise, people are going to be like, who is this guy?
No one ever thinks that.
You guys don't make edits in this?
Yeah, I edit.
This is one take show.
I edit,
Aaron,
and the longer it is, the worse
hell
the longer it
out
takes.
Of this show.
I'll try to.
Yeah, I take out all the ums, the breaths. Anytime you
say. Stuff I say. Gone.
Anytime you say something and you're wrong, that gets cut.
That makes me
sound
jokes
correct.
I'll make sure to jingle my change over the important parts I'm saying so the mic picks that up.
Right.
Yeah. all right. Well, I actually started as an anime fan because of manga when Torrin Smith and those guys at Studio Proteus were putting out through Dark Horse Outlanders. It was actually the first thing I ever saw. And then I started going to anime conventions starting with Icon in Long Island, and then the first Otakon.
What year?
94 was Otakon. Icon was, they had been doing it forever, but I guess it was 92.
What was the first year? What was the first Otakon?
First Otakon was 94 in Penn State.
So you went to the first one?
Yeah. I was there. I must have been the youngest person there.
Oh, okay.
I was a tiny little teenager, and everyone else was in college.
Like, he's trying to hide his age. And
yeah. I'm still cool. I got a MySpace. I'm not old. I'm not old school.
So I was really amazed to find, you know, people who liked it, but then people who still wouldn't talk to me because they had to go do things that involved alcohol, and then they didn't want to get arrested. But, the first Otakon was in a hotel. It was in a Days Inn. Which, you know, the Days Inn was small, but Otakon was so small that you could actually miss it in the Days Inn.
I passed it.
Yeah, wow. They had one guest who was Robert DeJesus, who was really cool about it because all he did, as far as I can remember, was like sit there and sign a lot of stuff. And I had him sign my program book, and I had a couple program books, and I had him sign it. And oddly enough, 10 years later, in 2004, I put one on eBay, and two people started bidding for it really,
one was
really
Robert
hard.
DeJesus.
No, actually one ended up being the official Otakon press office, and the other person ended up being Brian Ma, and I know a lot of people who hear the word Brian Ma right now are going, oh, snap!
Who's Brian Ma?
Brian Ma
press news.
Worked for Otakon, and he was involved in that New York anime club whose name I can't remember. They had the little drawing of the Statue of Liberty.
Okay.
It was the SVA thing.
Okay. Is it a different one from Metro Anime Society?
No, that's it. That's
yeah.
Okay.
They
had a thing for a while and they closed down and they came back?
Yeah. They got originally they got interviewed by TBS and then they got famous and then they didn't. That was that. But anyway, yeah, they actually bid that thing up to about, you know, $60. So I was kind of happy about that. But so that's pretty much my only memory of Otakon is that it was the first Otakon that filled a lot of old people who wouldn't talk to me. I saw Cream Lemon there. And I was like 13 or 14.
Your voice dropped, didn't
you? Yeah. I was like, oh my God, my parents brought me to this thing. Yeah. And I was able to buy Dragon Knight there, which is not something you should. It was so unregular. I mean, I couldn't even dream about that happening now. But and then the second Otakon, which was the best one because that was the one where we ruined that lady's wedding.
Is that like, I heard this one story, I don't know if it's true, where there's a wedding going on in the same hotel as an anime con.
Yes.
And one of the cosplayers ran up to the bride who was in her bridal gown, and she was like, oh my God, let me guess, Wedding Peach. And the bride was just furious.
I think that Heisenberg's theory of uncertainty has meant that that's actually happened a number of times. But I'm pretty sure the first one was there. I remember eating the reception's food because we were hungry and we didn't really care.
And the bride's like, where are these nerds? garbage eating my food.
She was crying. This would have been the best episode of Bridezilla's ever. Oh, that would have been great. Yeah, and the hotel was a hotel from the future. It was like a brand new hotel. It had digital displays of everything. The kind of adult theme continued because the first guest, the major guest, the headliner was Condom, the guy who brought us Bondage Fairies. And so the first thing I do is buy Bondage Fairies and get them to sign it, and I have an autographed Bondage Fairies at home.
And they sold it to you
because
whatever,
they didn't care.
Who
because they didn't care. Yeah. This was such a carefree time when, of the one or two legitimate companies in anime, like one being Orion and the other one, I guess, being, 80 Vision or I guess Central Park Media had more of a history at that point, they were not capable of getting there. Orion had its own problems, and they would file for bankruptcy later. And, the other companies were just not set up with their own infrastructure to send their own people. They just figured as long as the dealers were there, those were their accounts, and they would just go through that. And so there was a lot of bootlegs and a lot of, fan subs and other stuff for sale that you'd never see today just because that was the only way to get it.
Mm.
So a blind eye was kind of turned. There would have never been legal action unless it happened on a scale which, the conventions wouldn't see until after 2000.
Right.
Because the cons were so small, they probably just saw fan subs as like, well, they're promoting this medium.
I mean, exactly. That's what all the programming was. I mean, the programming was all fan subs. And then, I saw they had some fan dubs, and this was back before the internet ruined everything, and back when everybody had a 486, you really had to try hard to make a music video.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why guys like Dwayne Johnson, what they did for the fandom sadly sometimes goes forgotten because they put all these things together with, two LD decks and a SVHS.
Nice.
Well, now Cornbone is on YouTube. Ugh. So.
Yeah.
Before the internet ruined everything, anime was fun. And now it sucks. And Anime East, which was the New York area convention, happened in New Jersey. Okay? And that was the one where it was like, half Anime Con, half Sopranos episode.
What year was that?
This was 94, 95.
Okay, still 94.
And it stopped happening in 95 for one reason. Or maybe two reasons. First, that was the first major solo performance of Apollo Smile, which the company I worked for at the time.
No, actually,
the Apollo Smile saga runs about a decade.
Yeah,
a good decade of pure hell on earth. But I think all the Apollites are dead. I think they've been rounded up and killed, or have long since given up their faith.
I don't know if we should. I don't know if we want to go into the whole Apollo Smile story just now.
No.
We'll save that for the end. But we'll briefly mention who Apollo Smile was for those of you listening who maybe only be 15 right now. When back in the day when they first started airing anime on Sci-Fi Channel, she was the live action host who's American, who claimed to be a live anime character.
Live action anime girl.
That's her little tagline. And my company, which was Anime Crash, which was a chain of stores, first put her in that position only to help with promotional events at the store. We didn't really care about doing anything to the fandom. We knew not to mess with it. We were a business, and we were going to have her involved in a business way, just like, race car girls or whoever. And she got people in the store who normally wouldn't come in, people who didn't know what anime was, and we increased our consumer base. That's what that was for. Mm. And then at Anime East, she does this show, and she sees this huge room, and, people clap because it's the polite thing to do. And that's the day where she just said, I'm going off on my own. And in the store where we had her, that's when Sci-Fi Channel was located in New York, and the guy in charge of starting that whole anime block met her in the store. That's where he got the idea to put anime on Sci-Fi Channel.
Really?
And they kind of left.
Oh, my
with
God.
That. And so I've had to publicly apologize many times for calling her.
As well you should.
Yeah. But she is banned from Midtown Comics. That happened really early.
For a lifetime?
Yeah. Lifetime something regarding Dungeons & Dragons. She didn't play, but she hung out with one guy who did. The moment she got on TV, she stopped returning his phone call.
Aww.
At Anime East, the dealer's room was mostly full of unlicensed anime scrolls and tapes in a clamshell case. You could buy, a whole bunch of Ranma, a whole bunch of Gunbuster. You could buy, any of that stuff, and it wasn't licensed, so there really wasn't anybody to sue anybody over it. We were there, And we were the only table that was desperately trying to keep bootlegs off of our list and off of what we were selling, because we were actually doing business with Bandai and with JP Trading, companies that were opening up the legitimate business, and we had this company we were partnering with which wanted to do the absolute opposite. They were, you know, they had the Sanmei CDs in there and all this stuff. And
they're like dealing with pirates in the
open. I know. It's nuts. So, you know, eventually, you know, we had a little cardboard wall and it extended into a box wall, and pretty soon they were throwing bricks at each other. And the worst part was that the management of the con, I'm not sure if it was really them or just the fans that were there, all came down on the side of the bootleggers. Why? Because they had what everybody wanted and they were charging a lot less for it. And so, you know, a fight happens about, you know, where the tab is going, who's paying for what. And then in the lobby on, I think it was Saturday, of the New Jersey Hilton, they start having a big screaming match, and the Chinese guys take a swing at the Puerto Rican woman, who ain't gonna take that. I mean, she was just like, what the? So she leaps over one of the security dudes and goes bah, right in the mouth of this guy, just pow. And lays them out cold, and before you know it, you know hotel security, not just convention security, which was nothing but volunteers at the time, but hotel security is running up there. There had just been a murder suspect arrested in that hotel like a couple of weeks before who ran there, and you know, right, people who have been to this hotel, I mean, the only guys I guess who have been to Anime East, and I say guys because there were no girls at this thing.
Right.
This was way before.
Except for the Puerto Rican woman.
And
well, yeah, well,
smile.
She, the Puerto Rican woman, Apollo Smile, and the Puerto Rican woman, who I will not name, was just there to keep the book straight, and Apollo Smile did not know what planet she was on, so she doesn't count.
So this is when dealers attack.
Yeah, when dealers, and everybody's coming up and defending these bootleggers, and it looked like a riot was about to start, and they had to zoom out of there, and that pretty much ended Anime East. Well, that and the fact that Martin, who I'm naming names, you can bleep it out, I don't care, but the fact that one of the main principals of that convention just kind of took all the money and ran, and there were rumors that he left and fled to India, or that he was in another country, and people actually lost their houses because they mortgaged their house to finance this thing.
Oh my God.
It was a non-profit. They broke even, and this guy just opened up a Swiss bank account and disappeared. And that's what has kept an anime convention out of New York for a long time, until Anime Next, which...
What about, do you know the corruption story? It's about Big Apple Anime Fest.
Oh, good God, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
that whole
problem. But that comes that's later.
Yeah, well, that not, yeah, that was not that's much like later. New York is the holy grail for conventions because it's such a transportation hub, mm-hmm. and your core demographic doesn't own their own cars, but they sure as hell can get on a Metro North train or Amtrak.
That was why Big Apple Anime Fest, like 2002 or 2003, I forget, was the worst. Not the one that AX partnered with, but the regular Big Apple Anime Fest. Not 2001, because that was too soon. Maybe 2002 or something. Saturday was packed with kids with their parents who had come in from every borough and from Connecticut and from upstate.
And you're never going to leave your kid alone in Times Square.
No, and you wouldn't. And in this hotel, and like, it's... I can't imagine taking a kid to a con. And for a lot of parents, like, they'd never been to a con ever. Their kid had never been to a con. So, and the place was sold out, overcrowded. So at one point they closed the floor, the whole floor that the dealer's room was on. And we're just like, nope, just keep going up the escalator. So then you got angry parents who are like... What is this expensive crap fest with more things to buy, and now they don't even let you in?
Yeah, and
what
in
is
fact,
this?
They shut
furious.
Down the escalators, as I recall,
because
there were too many people, so you couldn't even get out. I'm sure that the fire marshal was thrilled.
Anyway,
and
so that only lasted
the worst years. Part about that was that some of the programming was not in that building. And the easiest way you can kill a con is to have half your programming not in the building where the other half is.
Right. Yeah.
You can have your hotel someplace, but don't split up your panels and your video rooms and your workshop and your dealer's room. And you can have the masquerade. You can have singular events in, like, large venues, but don't break up the entire staple programming between buildings that, you know, even if it's across the street, it's too far. So Big Apple was nowhere near as corrupt as Anime East was.
The corruption actually went down.
Yeah.
Did he ever resurface, this guy?
No. I got a picture of
he's
him
gone.
Somewhere. Yeah,
he's
I got
gone.
I got a picture of him from 1994, and there was a Japanese newspaper that was doing an article about how cool the gaijins love our anime.
Yeah.
Still missing.
Yeah. Well, so far as I know, I'm not really paying attention to this.
Maybe,
I know. All I know is I went to Anime Next and said the name out loud, and I think I had someone following me for the rest of the convention.
Ooh.
Oh man, that was the best anime expo ever. I am so ready to go home.
Dude, there's one more day left.
Oh yeah, that's right. They saved the best for last.
Don't you mean the worst for last?
No, it's the best for last, because it's the Podcasting with Anime Genesis panel, Monday, July 2nd, at 11:30 a.m. in room 103 at the Long Beach Convention Center at Anime Expo 2007. You can meet your favorite Anime Genesis host, learn how to start your own podcast, and be a part of the live taping of the show.
Anime Genesis is Benno Into a Matrix. Anime Genesis put together by Benno Into a Matrix with the help of my friends. Into a Matrix will not actually be at Anime Expo this year.
Okay, but back in the day, you majored in Japanese, no one else did.
No, that's not back in the day.
Oh, you mean
if it starts 1990 anything, that does not count as back in the day. And this is a problem I had with the last Otakon old school anime panel. There should be definitive starts and ends, actual dates to where old school ends and post old school begins, and then you have pre new school, just like modern and postmodern. These have actual dates. Because if you leave it subjective, it's never going to change. And then before you know it, you're going to have Mesozoic anime and all this stuff.
But if you leave people who don't know the answers to those questions in charge of the old school panel, you're going to get the abortion that was that.
They got a lot of feedback. Not least from just me, about how bad that panel was. But
I didn't feel like getting arrested in Baltimore. That was the only reason I didn't storm the stage.
This year, I think the actual old men will be back. But we do have at least one listener who writes into our show and is like, you know what old school is? It's where you trade 60mm film that you stole from TV stations because there was no home video.
Yes.
And
that's
old.
That is middle period old school. Okay, early period old school would be the day that, and I just wrote about this on my blog, on my podcast, and I'm going to say it again, animepodcast.net, because it has relevant information, but that is the day Osamu Tezuka figured out. This is the day anime started, not when Astro Boy necessarily came out, but the day he figured out that you could reproduce the 36 frames per second by taking 3 frames and shooting them 8 times. Because he studied medicine before he did what he did, and he had some guys who knew about ocular processing come in and help him figure out how to fool the eye with a lot less frames. And that's how he was able to make Astro Boy under budget, and that's anime just pretty much took off from
that. And that's where you get the sense that, so like for example in Walt Disney Animation, because they're doing feature films, they would shoot animation on 2s, so you get everything shot for 2 frames for each pose, and it has a very fluid look to it. But the only people who ever do that now are people who have a giant budget like Disney, because obviously it creates a ton of work.
Well, exactly. If you look at stuff that Tezuka has claimed were his influences, like Popeye.
Yeah.
That was all one. They had one frame, you know, per.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
Yeah. When yeah, you know, and without air conditioning.
Yeah.
Wherever these guys were drawn, they did not have air conditioning in the buildings. Yeah. They were just doing that.
No, they had Betty Boop's boyfriend lugging up the giant block of ice up the stairs.
Yeah, it's a miracle that those guys A, got it done, and B, you know, stayed sober. And so that
I don't think they stayed sober.
Well, they stayed sober enough.
My tradition of animators.
Sober enough to. That is, and you can say whatever you want, but actual science backs it up that that's the day anime started.
Now, our only hope for salvation lies in the brave men and women of Otaku USA, navigating through this sea of pop culture to bring you the best in anime, gaming, cosplay, and much, much more. Mankind only has 1 year left before the Aurora Mundane takes effect. Waste no time and do your part to help stave off the threat. Buy a copy of Otaku USA Magazine today. www.otakuusamagazine.com. Good luck, brave warriors of love.
I think we're going to leap ahead to what I requested here about the founding of Media Blasters, which broke off from Central Park Media.
Okay.
Since you don't work for either of those companies.
No, I don't, and I probably never will after this. But I'm not going to speak ill of anyone, because that'll just that'll just make it worse. But Media Blasters started as a division inside Central Park Media. The person who is now in charge of Media Blasters was once at Central Park Media, and he started his own division after, you know, he made Software Sculptors. And
still using the same logo.
Yeah. And then he licensed a bunch of stuff that there's a lot of controversy about how he was able to do that and whether or not it counts as either tortious interference, which is kind of low on the whole criminal scale, or industrial sabotage, which is kind of high. So.
Well, but we'll let the lawyers figure that out.
Yeah, and I don't mean to be dredging up. I hope nobody's listening that has horrible memories of these things. But you know, he went his way with a bunch of things which, you know, I would not have done. I would have called unethical. So he had these licenses, and he started Media Blasters and did quite well because he knew what to license. And the reason he knew what to license was because he would come down to where I worked and kind of poach our customers and tell them if they didn't come in that store anymore and just took his stuff for cost, he'd actually get in there, tell our customers that he would sell his tapes to them for less because it only cost him maybe $1.25 to make them, and we were selling them, we had to mark them up because we were getting them through the distributor, that he would let them do this if he could pick their brain. And these, you know, hardcore talkers are more than happy to just blab about what they like. And you know, he got some guys up, and they said, "This new thing called Rares, and it's great, and I would love you to licensing it, and I think you should, and it's awesome." I just offended everybody. I just offended all your listeners, didn't
no,
I?
No, none of them have heard of it.
Oh, okay.
And they probably don't even know Rares.
Really?
No, probably not. I
feel really old. Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, they'd be there, and they'd be licensing these things, and he did really well with Kenshin, and then... And then, you know, you gotta be ready for the big change, and the DVD, VHS, you know, thing happened a lot faster than anybody could have anticipated, and it sent everybody reeling. Anybody who was in the business had a big problem with that. And
I remember some of the first DVDs I saw on the market were anime DVDs.
First anime DVD was from Central Park Media. I mean, uh-huh. John O'Donnell's ahead of his time. He has a background at Sony. He's a smart guy. He's never going to go away. And you know, don't ever count. Yeah, don't ever count CPM out, because he will find a way to still be there,
despite how many times they go bankrupt.
Yeah, you can count their staff out sometimes, but don't ever count that company out. He's a smart guy, and I've worked with a lot of his former, you know, staff that were, you know, really really long time in the video business. I mean, mm-hmm. since the 70s, and which I was not alive in the 70s, by the way, just to kind of get that.
I was born for 1 year.
You were a little bit.
Yeah, no,
you know, I'm trying to build
like,
this. You know, I'm trying to do some propaganda
sorry.
Here. And, I guess I can legally say I have no recollection of the 70s.
Oh, okay.
Because of being very young. But yeah, anyway, he had a lot of old guys who really knew the video business, and he was the first one in everything. He had, unfortunately, the first anime on DVD was Ballerinas of Shinden, which that year...
Wait, is that about Ballerinas?
No. Ballerina.
Oh.
Yeah.
Ballerinas of Shinden would be better.
Ballerina?
Trust me on this. Yeah, Ballerinas of Shinden.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually it would, because that was one of the... That was the second title ever to make it into Mystery Anime Theater 3000. And they were good sports about that, but yeah, that was pretty rough. And actually, that's the only version I've seen it is during the anime Mystery Anime Mystery Theater 3000. I had the front row seat for that.
At the last one they did, I saw Crusher Joe, not one of the better episodes or whatever, but that's like the only time I've seen Crusher Joe.
Yeah.
Also. And the only time I've seen the one with the dinosaur puppets. Like, I've seen that a couple times. It mixes animation and live action and horrible dinosaur puppets.
Right.
They show that Anime thing, Hell yeah. And yeah. That and Mystery Anime Theater.
Oh, God.
Maybe we should go into that.
Yeah.
Or start with something else.
Mm.
Even every Otakon.
I've been to every Otakon, and I feel I feel ill now. I've been to every Otakon and have never ever staffed or volunteered once, and I don't think I ever will.
At any con at all?
No, I've run my own. I've chaired a con before. Oh. I chaired a con convention in Albany in the year 2000, and I was actually reading an interview a lot later. Someone was interviewing a writer for, you know, Animerica or something like that, and then she said her first anime con was the con that I chaired, and I just felt so bad. Because it was a disaster. It was awful. Because you should, I mean, running a con is really, there's a lot more you got to do than you expect, and there you will always lose 50% of the people who agree to help you out. Especially if you're gonna, you know, do this in a college environment. I lost everybody. I was doing it
100%.
Yeah, we had some decent guests too. We had the voice of Jigglypuff. And we had, actually Taiko Baba showed up. She had this amazing demographic breakdown of otakuism and was, you know, juxtapositioning the Japanese, you know, market with its fairly, you know, separated groups of fandom with the American market, which at the time still was one of complete consumption. You could actually, if you were into anime, you could buy every manga, every anime, every magazine related to manga and anime at once. It wouldn't bankrupt it because there were like three.
Well, okay, in the English language.
Coming out commercially in the United States, that's what there was. When Adivision was doing clamshell cases, you know, when VHS was still the dominant force.
Daryl and Gerald talk about like when they were in high school, and I thought they were a lot older than they were at first because I didn't have any money in high school. Apparently they did, because they would go to whatever, the comic book store every week and just buy every anime-related product available, which didn't break bank.
In a month you'd spend like $25.
Wow.
More than that,
because those tapes cost a lot, especially the subs.
That is true. And you know, I working as in an anime store at the time, people completely did not believe you that the reason the subtitle version cost so much more was because there were less of them, and that was the only reason. It's supply and demand.
Yes.
The less of something there is, the more it's going to cost. And we had no control. The stores had no control over how much we had to pay for the distributor to get them. And so we had to just double the price, and that was it. And if the original price is like $15, then it's going out for
$30.
And stores still do that.
Like the DVD market is different. Like in Japan, those DVDs cost twice as much as they do here.
Yeah.
So
people just, and it's the same in the UK, people just don't consume media like they do here.
But like in Japan they don't?
No.
Because they don't buy as many DVDs.
No, they can't. I mean, they don't maybe they don't because they're that expensive.
Yeah.
Or maybe they don't because they don't have the room.
Yeah, they don't have the shelf
and,
space.
And, you know, it's possible that a lot of VOD service and broadcast service is kind of making up for that.
Yeah, or they're not insane. They are insane.
The thing is, there are otaku in Japan who will do that. And then, you know, in Japan, you can watch anime and you're not an otaku.
Yeah.
And then they won't do that.
A little bit, except for the 2 a.m. shows. Then I think you kind of are. If you're staying up each night to watch everything.
I was jet-lagged.
Six months?
Yes.
I don't think so.
The thing is, there's like 9 or 10 network channels, and 3 or 4 of them are showing anime, even if you don't have cable or anything.
Yeah.
Then you're pretty much watching
it. It's hard to live there and avoid it completely.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was living in Nagoya, I would watch Jungo wa Itsumo Hare no Chigu because at the time, you know, on TV, there were 3 other choices, you know, that weren't news, and they were all anime. So even if I wanted to watch, you know, a variety show or something like that, I couldn't. It was anime. So you find yourself watching that kind of thing. I'll tell you, and you guys have been there, and you guys know this. And if you live there, the worst thing an American otaku can do is go to Japan. The worst thing you can do is go there. It's going to shatter everything you think Japan is like.
I was really bummed that Akihabara was not all geeks, that there were mostly normal people.
Yeah, I know, imagine that. A giant city like Tokyo, just mostly full of normal people.
And even by the electronics district, then you get all the way in the back of K-Books, near the maid posters, and then there's the freaks.
Yeah.
Down on the street, it's all normal people.
Yeah, because, you know, freakism, you know, and fandomism, I guess you can call it, you know, it's not embraced as expressing your individuality over there.
No.
You're a part of the problem, you're not part of the solution.
Yeah, I think the last thing you want to do in Japan in general is express your individuality.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, the way you do it, you do it quietly. You do it through your clothes, and you never do it in a way that's going to cause problems for anyone else's morning commute. That's
right. Like those Haruhi dancers who scattered when the cops show up.
Yeah.
The cops just walked through.
They didn't
even
show
was like
up.
The most disappointing internet video.
Might not have even been a cop.
No, it was just like the street cop. Yeah.
Some guy cosplaying a cop. I wonder if that's legal.
Probably not.
Japan.
In this city, it would take a lot more to break up a street riot than just some cops walking through. It would take a freaking...
Unarmed
cops.
Yeah. Well, like, I'll tell you, they
shame you.
A lot of authority. They really do. The one place you don't want to end up is Japanese prison.